Good evening. All right. So we are going to continue our discussion on what I kind of generally call Christian apologetics. Deals more specifically with the New Testament aspects. And in the last week, we laid the foundation for a study in Christian apologetics. And there were three things that I talked about, and you hopefully listened, concerning what the Christian faith is. There were three points that I made. Anybody remember any of them from last week? And I apologize if you didn't, because that was on me. I talked the whole time. Okay, number one is our faith is an objective faith. So it's a faith that has an object. Of course, that faith is Jesus the Christ. The second one was that it is a historical faith, that it's based on real people, places, and events, that things that actually happened in history. And then the last one was an intelligent and rational faith, a faith that invites people to use their noggins and hopefully get something out of it when they study it. So one of the things that we want to do tonight is we want to look at the historical evidence that logically supports placing one's faith in the Jesus of Nazareth as the Son of God. And specifically with this in mind, we want to consider the evidence that establishes Jesus as an actual historical figure, one who actually lived in Palestine during the first century AD. You might wonder, well, why? Was there really ever even a question about whether or not Jesus existed? Well, to start off with, there have been skeptics who believe that Jesus was just a myth. This concept was popular with a lot of the scholars in the 1800s, specifically the latter half of the 1800s. Anybody know what other book was released in the 1850s? What's that? Okay, that's not the one I'm looking for. Origin of Species was released in the 1850s. So it's not surprising that the next step was that people started attacking whether or not Jesus was actually a real person. And there are some today who deny that the real Jesus existed. And while most people won't say that Jesus today, most people won't say that Jesus didn't exist. Instead, what they'll say is that he was either an invention of the Romans or a reinvention of the pagan gods by those who came after. And if you do a Google search and you type in Google, did Jesus, you'll see all kinds of, you know, filled in possible results. And I think the fourth one, it was first about 5 years ago when I did this last. But I think it's like the fourth or fifth one. It adds the suggestion exist. So it is something that people still ask a question about today. And others take it a little bit more in a peculiar direction. And they would say that while Jesus existed, he wasn't a real human. He was an alien. How many of you have seen the movie? It's a little bit old now. It's called Man of Steel. It was kind of the remake of it. Anybody remember a scene in that where they basically tried to say that Jesus was an alien? It was really subtle. It infuriated me, and I don't remember anything after that. There's a part in the movie where Superman walks into a church, and he's standing next to a stained glass window, and there's Jesus in the stained glass window. I mean, you know, in the stained glass, not like, you know, peeking in or anything. But he's depicted in this particular piece of stained glass, and there was a very subtle yet powerful suggestion that was made during that movie that Jesus was an alien, just like Superman. And while they didn't come out and say it, you can tell because of the way that was presented. So the reality is that these are questions that you're going to get. So what we're going to see, though, is that the skeptics are generally ignorant of the facts, which is, you know, not uncommon. And they purposely suppress the evidence, as was done in formerly communist-dominated countries, about the historical Jesus. So if somebody were to come up to you and they learn or they think that you're a Christian, and they ask you or they say, you know, Jesus wasn't He didn't really exist. He was just made up. How would you answer that? What evidence would you use to support it? Well, I have lots of, you know, snappy little comebacks, but I'll stick to the evidence portion. The reality is that really for the last 150 or so years, if you want to probably stretch that out a little bit, no serious historian, even those who are atheists, disputes the fact that Jesus ever existed. Famous atheists, you ever heard of a guy named H.G. Wells? Wrote several books. He died a long time ago, but he was very influential in the entertainment industry when entertainment was books and plays. He was very influential. He was an atheist, and he spoke of Jesus in his book. He actually wrote a history book. It's called Outline of History, and he basically said, one is obliged to say, here was a man. This part of the tale could not have been invented. Basically saying that the rest of the tale had been invented of Jesus. Even those who were professors of philosophy at large universities such as Columbia University, one of the guys' names was Will Durant, he's passed away now, but he was hugely influential in the development of the philosophy system at Columbia University, which Columbia University is supposedly a Christian university. The guy was an agnostic, and he taught at one of the most popular at the time Christian universities in the United States. Okay, do the math on that one real quick. Doesn't make a lot of sense, but he wrote a book called The Story of Our Civilization. It was very influential, and he spent two chapters depicting Jesus as a historical figure right along with the Caesars. So what we're getting at is that even though there were atheists and agnostics that were very influential in their circles, they still admitted that Jesus existed. If you ever look, anybody familiar with what an encyclopedia is? Most of you are well under the age. I remember having to do book reports for me from encyclopedias. Get writer's cramp just because you couldn't photocopy it and you couldn't just copy and paste. Yeah. So anyway, Encyclopedia Britannica, it used over 20,000 words to describe Jesus. That's more than Aristotle, Cicero, Alexander, Julius Caesar, Buddha, Confucius, Muhammad, or Napoleon. So that's pretty cool. The Encyclopedia Britannica, I would certainly not call it a Christian publication, but they certainly admitted that Jesus existed. So there appears to be sufficient evidence, at least, to have convinced the folks of these writers and others like them that Jesus actually did live. So we get that relatively easy question out of the way. So what other evidence is there to support that Jesus was a historical figure, that he actually existed? Well, it's easy from our perspective and from our influence to be able to draw from the things that we're familiar with. I mean, I want to ask you the question, and you don't necessarily have to answer unless you want to, but had you thought of how to answer this question before? Believe it or not, it's one that I've gotten in some way, shape, or form. And so it's easy for us to draw from the stuff that we're familiar with, but what's even better is when we can draw from stuff that should not support our argument. That's like in the discussion of evolution, specifically biologic evolution. It's great when you can get the quotes from, like, for instance, Darwin, who basically writes out all the things that you need to disprove evolution. And we can draw from those things to help prove our point. Well, the same thing can be said about the pagan sources that are out there. And there were many. One of them is by the name of Thallus, T-H-A-L-L-U-S. He was a Samaritan historian, roughly 52 A.D. He wrote several volumes. There are some fragments from three of the volumes from the history of the Mediterranean. And he wrote about Jesus, so 52 A.D., so that wasn't very long after his crucifixion, about 20 years. And he was trying to explain how the crucifixion of Jesus, because everybody would have known about it at this time, especially in the area, that he was trying to explain away the crucifixion of Jesus as a natural event. Didn't try to deny that Jesus existed, but only tried to explain away the strange circumstances surrounding his death. And I'm not 100% sure, but I think that this is kind of where some of the more modern-day scoffers got the idea of group hypnotism or group hysteria. I think they got it from Thallus. Not 100% certain. And then there's another guy written around 73 A.D., and I'm going to slaughter his name, and you can ask my wife. I was practicing this, and I still can't remember it. It's Amara Serapion, however you want to say that. He was a Stoic philosopher from the Roman province of Syria, and he tells of the deaths of Socrates, Pythagoras, and of Jesus, and he specifically mentions the crucifixion of Jesus, and he says this about Jesus. What advantage did the Jews gain from executing their wise king? Nor did the wise king die for good. He lived on in the teaching which he had given. So, doesn't necessarily say Jesus is the Christ, but he says Jesus existed. And this is from times right around when, of course, the events had occurred. Another Roman historian, his name was Cornelius Tacitus, from about AD 55 to AD 118. He was among Rome's most notable and really prolific historians. You probably heard of Tacitus. Cornelius Tacitus was his name. And he was really never given to careless writing. He was very careful about what he wrote and very careful in his details. And he writes of Jesus in his Annals of History, written 116 to 117 AD, and he includes in it a biography of Nero. Okay, so if you know anything about Nero, he was not a good guy. He was crazy as a loon and a horrible, immoral person. And he writes that Nero was suspected of setting fire to a portion of Rome where he wanted to carry out a building project. But he couldn't burn down his own city. So anybody know what Nero did? He blamed the Christians. That's a convenient way of removing a political opposition, huh? Cause the problem and then blame it on somebody else. And so that's what Nero did. But he tried to shift the blame to the Christians, and it is in this context that Tacitus mentions the Christians, whom Tacitus despised. Read some of the other writings that Tacitus had related to it, and whom Nero didn't like either, of course. Didn't like him much. This is what Tacitus had to say. It's fairly long, but it's worth reading. He says, "Neither human effort nor the emperor's generosity, okay, nor the placating of the gods ended the scandalous belief that the fire had been ordered by Nero. Therefore, to put down the rumor, Nero substituted as culprits and punished in the most unusual ways those hated for their shameful acts, whom the crowd called Christians," or Christians is technically how it was spelled. The founder of this, named Christ, had been executed in the reign of Tiberius by the procurator Pontius Pilate, which suppressed for a time the deadly superstition, Christianity, but it erupted again not only in Judea, the origin of this evil, but also in the city, Rome, where all things horrible and shameful from everywhere come together and become popular. You think, I think Tacitus had many good things to say about Christianity? Well, no, obviously he didn't. But he acknowledged who Christ was. See, Tacitus's brief reference here to Jesus, it corroborates the historical details of Jesus' death as it was depicted in the New Testament. So, Christus, which was used by Tacitus to refer to Jesus, was one of the distinctive ways by which the historians and the politicians of that time and the commoners would refer to Jesus. And he, Tacitus, assumed it was his first name. He wasn't the first, and he certainly wasn't the last. I mean, how many times you talk to people and, you know, they think Jesus was his first name and Christ was his last name, not a title. So it's not all that unusual. But Christus was associated with the beginning of the Christian movement. He mentions he was executed by the Roman governor. And the time of his death during Pontius Pilate's governorship of Judea during the reign of Tiberius, all this lines up with the New Testament record. Another pagan source was Pliny the Younger. Ever heard of Pliny the Younger? If you're a student of history, you'll know who Pliny the Younger was, or Pliny is another way that it's pronounced sometimes. Many things. He was a politician. He was a writer. He was a bit of an inventor. He was a financial whiz. Also a bit of a historian. He was also the governor of Bithynia. And in around 112 AD, he wrote a number of things. But he was no friend of Christianity either. If you're going to be popular in the Roman politics, it did not do you any good to be favorable of Christianity. As a matter of fact, he was also a lawyer, a very good one, a very good orator, as they were called in the time. And he most likely supervised trials and questioned people accused of being Christians and judged and punished those found guilty in the same way that Tacitus had done. He wrote to Emperor Trajan about Christians and their rather strange devotion to Christ. And the reason he wrote to Trajan, which I find really interesting, was that he was wary of their devotion and their regular meeting together. Why? Well, because he viewed it as at the time, as sedition. What's the saying? If you refuse to learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. Yeah. How about another one? Suetonius. He was a court official and the analyst under Hadrian, 120 AD. He writes, as the Jews were making constant disturbance at the instigation of Crestus, okay, he wrote in 120 AD, he expelled them from Rome. So 120 AD, of course, when he says at the urging or at the the instigation of Crestus, he was meaning Christianity. Suetonius mentions that Hadrian pushed them all out. Now, of course, he was writing a little bit backwards, looking back in time. Luke makes reference to this same expulsion in Acts chapter 18. So if you go back and you read through that, you might remember a couple of people that were involved in that. Yeah, Priscilla and Aquila, they become really important folk. Just as a little bit of a side note here, when you consider the amount of, well, when you consider that the whole world was against the first century church, it's really encouraging to see that those things worked out for good. Priscilla and Aquila being run out of Rome, it was actually a really good thing. So, at any rate, so that's from the original pagan sources. And there's many others to establish that Jesus was an actual person, that he lived when the New Testament claims he did, and that he died in the way that the New Testament claimed he did. Even those who are writing that trying to say that the resurrection and the circumstances of his death were nothing more than a naturalistic miracle. So, pretty significant source or a set of sources there. Here's a couple more. Jewish sources. If you're familiar with what the Talmud is, it's basically two separate books. It deals with the Jewish law. It was written between 100 AD and 500 AD, and during that time frame. And it speaks frequently of Jesus of Nazareth. It's not as if the Jewish religion doesn't believe that Jesus existed. They absolutely know that he did, and they obviously write about him in the Talmud. But they don't really write about him in friendly terms, as you could probably imagine. But they never dispute him as a historical figure. Here's another one. How about Flavius Josephus? Anybody heard of Josephus? I mean, I think we have a copy of one of his books in the library back there. But he was a Jewish general turned Roman historian. He was born 37 AD, and he makes several references to Jesus in his history of the Jews. Specifically, he says, and brought before it the brother of Jesus, the so-called Christ, whose name was James. So he certainly makes reference to Jesus several times. And so there's a tremendous amount of evidence, really, that we can take into account from any source. So The reason that I bring this up is, and again, it does seem like it's a strange thing to cover, but there's implications behind this. And this is why we should study things like this. Not just to know it, but to know how to apply it and how to use it in our conversations. So what this information or what this evidence does do is it provides a solid basis upon which one can intelligently believe in Jesus as a person who actually existed in history. Now, let's put this on the other side. One of my favorite responses, or maybe it depends on the situation, I should say. I'm most excited when I can use this particular response is when somebody says that the information about Jesus is wrong and that, you know, he didn't really do the things that he did and so on and so forth. And I'll ask him, well, how do you know anything about George Washington? Did you live in that time frame? How do you know anything about LeBron James? Have you ever met him? I mean, think about it. Pretty much everything we know about people that aren't within our circle of influence and within our sphere, we get from other sources. And yet we tend to trust those things over the things that might actually have some sort of important meaning. So what this information does help us do is to establish that Jesus did actually exist. And it really exposes the shallow thinking of any who would try to mark Jesus off as a myth. It doesn't happen much anymore, but it is still a possibility that you'll run into. Just for a quick verse reference, I think is interesting. Matthew chapter 16. Matthew chapter 16. I'm going to start in verse 13. See, the reason I give you this information is so that we can answer the question that Jesus asks Peter. He says, "Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he was asking his disciples, 'Who do people say that the Son of Man is?' And they said, 'Some say John the Baptist, and others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets.' He said to them, 'But who do you say that I am?'" And of course, I realize that the statement is much bigger than that, and I realize that our answer should be much more simple than a man of history. But this at least gives you some evidence to give to people to go back to it and to look it out, to research it themselves if they decide to. So what this evidence does not do, though, and this is where you come in, is the evidence does not prove Jesus to be the Son of God. All it does is prove that he existed. None of this that we've talked about does anything to lend credibility to what we believe about Jesus. Only that he existed. Only that he existed. In fact, it doesn't really tell us anything about Jesus, other than he lived and died and had a pretty significant impact during the first century AD. And, you know, I've always found it interesting that we start counting centuries when Jesus was supposedly born. I find that interesting, but he certainly had a big impact. But it does tell us that he lived and died and that he must have done something pretty significant. So to learn more about who Christ is, we've got to look elsewhere. We've got to learn and we've got to look into the scriptures and understand what these 27 books really are. See, these 27 books are more than a collection of writings from a few different authors that tell us a fanciful story about a man. But we've got to consider these books as the very handwriting of God. It's really the only true and reliable source of information that we have about Jesus. So this actually begs the next question. Are these books reliable? I remember when we were first being discipled, I was probably not an easy person to study with, I will be perfectly honest. But it was mainly because I thought I had tough questions that people had never been able to answer. And in reality, they were just really silly. And but at any rate, I remember when we were being discipled that I asked the person who was discipling us, "Well, why is it that we study this book?" And he had an okay answer at the time. Because my perspective was, well, what if in 1,000 years society and culture have gone through a complete upheaval? And everything as we know it is gone, and in 1,000 years from now, somebody finds a copy of Gulliver's Travels. What would prevent them from using that book as a holy book? Why is that book less believable as a religious book than the Bible? Well, I think we need to be able to answer that question. Maybe one not quite so put in that direct of a manner. But we need to be sure that what we have is actually what was penned by the original authors. And this is really where the rubber hits the road when we start to talk about New Testament apologetics. We need to be able to answer the questions that people have about how accurate this particular book is. And that's what I'm probably not going to get too far into it tonight, but that's what our next study is going to focus on, is an attempt to answer the questions of, is this book historically reliable? And as we've laid out some of the one block upon another as a foundation for the rest of our faith, hopefully what we've seen is that it is more logical to believe that Jesus did in fact exist and than it is to assert that he is a myth. So when Jesus asked that question, who do you say that I am, we can answer that not only from the biblical perspective, but from a historical perspective. So when we begin to look at the New Testament apologetics from the perspective of this book having been written, I would like to hear from some of the guys about some of the questions that they've received in regards to this question. Have any of you guys ever been asked about the authenticity and reliability of the scriptures? Well, how do the people normally ask the question? Do they just like that? Or do they put it another way? I'm asking. It's not a rhetorical question.
They just say, how do
they
know it's not written by man?
Okay. And I was going to ask what your response is, but I'm pretty sure you have a good response. The reason that this question comes up is because the book means more than just the words on the page. Okay? So when we ask about the authorship of the New Testament, there are a few key things that we want to consider as we get into some of the study. Oh man, I'm really early, but I'm also really late. I don't want to get halfway through this. Okay, so we know that the New Testament writers, when they wrote, many of them did not write at the time immediately when the events had occurred. Now, this is an important thing to consider. Because the further away the writing is of an event, the less historically accurate it is. You may have heard me mention a guy by the name of Pythagoras. Anybody hear some really interesting news about Pythagoras lately? Anybody know who Pythagoras was and what he invented or what he's credited? Okay, mathematics, but specifically the Pythagorean theorem. So if you know anything about Pythagoras, he was supposedly the person who invented modern-day mathematics. Specifically, the Pythagorean theorem is named after him. Did you know that they found a tablet dated to 1,000 years before Pythagoras that explained in a more clear manner the Pythagorean theorem? It's actually easier. The formulas are easier. So 1,000 years before Pythagoras was born, somebody else had already figured it out. Well, why is this important? Well, because Pythagoras lived a long time ago. And we assume, looking back in history, that the information we have today is 100% accurate, but we're so far removed from the actual events that it's possible to be wrong. Now, we'll get into some of more of the detail next week, but anybody know the most prolific example of ancient literature outside of the scripture? Like the oldest book you can think of that has the highest number of copies? That's not that old. Maybe it is to you, Micah, but it's not that old. Yep, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and specifically the Iliad. Yeah. You know what the earliest copies, or how the earliest copies of that book from the events that actually occurred, you know what the time frame is from there? It's about 700 to 1,000 years after the events had taken place. And that is one of the most prolific books of antiquity that were written well after the events. And yet, when we look at the books like the Iliad and the Odyssey, we don't necessarily question whether or not they're accurate. And we base our history books on writings that were 700 years after the events had occurred. Anybody know? This one's fun. Anybody know when the earliest examples of New Testament writings were found or were dated to? What's your guess? If you don't know, just give me a guess. Raise your hand and tell me what you think. How far after the events had occurred do we have copies or fragments of copies from the events that they were describing? Anybody have an idea, a guess? 585, okay, that's 600 years. 1100 AD, that's a long time after, okay. Okay, 200, 300. You know, there's a fragment of what they think, and they're pretty sure, is the fragment of Mark. That was within the first century. Why is that important? Because as we begin to tie all these pieces of fragment writings together, of which there are many, 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 many thousands of examples of New Testament writings, whether in whole or in fragments, primarily fragments, that match so well, that were written so close to the events that had occurred, that we can begin to trust them from what's called the bibliographic sense. So as we get into some of this evidence, one of the things that we're going to be looking for is where do we draw the line for when we determine whether something is accurate or not? What does it require? And before I get into all the details, I want you to think of key events in your life. How many of you, and please raise your hands, were born after 2001? Oh, okay, so this isn't raising your hand. This is showing me your nails. quite a number of you were born after 2001. Anybody know why I'm asking about 2001 specifically? 9/11. Now, I was alive, obviously, during that time, because I'm old now. I'm getting there. I'm going to be a grandpa, so I guess I'm getting old. I am a grandpa, but I haven't helped a child yet. Have you seen any writing about 9/11? Any books written? Any movies made? Any documentaries on YouTube? Kevin says he sees a lot of propaganda. Now, I ask this because the further and further we get away from events like this, that are major events, the fewer number of people there are around to corroborate or to correct, dispute's probably a better word, but correct is what they're hopefully going to try to do, the information that's written. So when we begin to look at things like the New Testament has some really neat historical examples, some really good bibliographic information and evidence to help us support that what we have today is accurate and has come down to us just as the Lord had intended. And partially that is based upon things like bibliographic evidence, autograph evidence as well, although we don't have the original autographs. Anybody know what an autograph is? Yeah, it's not what you stand in line for to get from your favorite sports person or politician, because people have favorite politicians, believe it or not. The autographs are the original writings. So we have really good evidence from that perspective. Also, we have archaeological evidence to support their writings in antiquity. And we also have many other things that we can do to test writing fragments that we found. And all of what this will help us to do is to establish the New Testament letters within a very short time after the events had occurred. Now, one of the earliest fragments is hotly disputed. And we'll talk a little bit about it. I'm not going to get too much into it. And the dispute is not whether or not it is a copy of one of the letters. It's the age. And some of it is as early as 50s, while the apostles were still alive. Okay. So this actually leads me to a rather minor point that I want to make before we wrap up for tonight. This is something that I've always found interesting. It has to do with the reason why the Lord, I think, preserved it in the way that he did. How many of you have electronic Bibles? How many of you rely on electronic Bibles? Please don't. Okay, so the reason that the Lord preserved the Bible in written format and then had everybody copy it, by the way, if you look at the way that they would do it, a church would get a letter and they would make several copies of it. They would keep the original, generally, if it was written to them, and then they would disperse the rest to neighboring churches. And that church would take a copy and they would make several copies, and they would keep one, and then they would disperse it. And I think that the reason that the Lord did this was to preserve a historical record and account of the Scriptures that is accurate to the original letters. So this brings me to my point. I think it's an interesting thought. I can't technically prove it, but I think it's interesting. According to 2 Corinthians, chapter 13. When were the gifts of the Holy Spirit going to go away? Somebody that's not these two. Okay, when the perfect comes, what's the perfect? You're right, the completed Word of God. Okay. Up until that point, what was the purpose of the gifts? What was part of the purpose in reference to what we're talking about? What's that? To build the church, right? Shh. Okay, right. To basically be able to verify what somebody might claim to be from God, the gifts would enable them to be able to make that distinction. To be able to say, yes, what this person is saying does line up with the Lord's gospel, with the Lord's writings, with the Lord's truth, right? When did the last apostle, roughly, who was the last apostle to die, and when did he, approximately when did he die? You just stop. You're moving your mouth and people are watching. No, just kidding. It was John, right? About when? You don't have to get exact. What was that? Okay, you can't answer again anymore either. So about late 90s, 96, 98. Did John have the ability to pass on the gifts of the Holy Spirit? Did he have any disciples? Do you think it's possible that John, before he died, and probably well before he died, had maybe laid his hands on somebody and the Holy Spirit decided to give them the gift of discernment? So that by the time the letters that John had written the last one of course, Revelation, that by the time the letters had the opportunity to circulate around the churches, that they at one point or another would make it back to somebody who could say, yes, this is accurate, or no, this Gospel of Judas is bunk. Think it's possible? Think the Lord works in not so mysterious ways to make sure that his word has been preserved down through the centuries? So, to bring this all back, this is why the book, in writing, is so important in paper. I am of a firm belief that the more paper Bibles you have, the better off you are, and you can never have too many. Digital Bibles can be easily shut off. Digital Bibles can easily be changed, and a number of other things that go along with the whole digital aspect. Okay, so I think it's enough of an introduction for next week. I don't want to get into more of the meat. Any questions or comments before we close for the evening?
So definitely liked the study of the secular sources of Christ and his existence. I found a digital source of a secondary education, like a university, that has been collecting Greek and ancient Greek texts and converting it to English and to a digital format. Mm-hmm. And I've only found like three of them on there that you mentioned tonight, but I'm interested in finding the rest of those. But as perseus.tufts.edu, and that's where I found Sextus Africanus, Josephus, and Cornelius. So those are the three that I saw on there. But it was really neat.
Yeah. And those are the three that are very, very commonly referenced in antiquity from about them writing about Jesus. So anybody else have any other questions or comments? Okay. Oh, Brad's way in the back.
Yeah, don't get too close. Okay. Anyway, the thing is, you notice how man's history, how they keep on changing it all the time. But the Bible's never changed. Yeah. I mean, it's gone through all these ages. And so, I mean, that to me is wow. Yeah. But man changes stuff for their own agenda. And so...
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think one of the things that warrants discussion is, I guess I'll just say it, bad Bible translations. And there are a lot of them. Anybody ever heard of, what was it, the word? No.
Message.
The Message. That's what it was. It's not even a paraphrase. It's a fanciful telling of somebody's, I don't know, hallucinogenic vision of what they thought Jesus was. But at any rate, so any other questions or comments? All right, thank you for your time.